Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, editor Andrew S. Curran and biological anthropologist Nina G. Jablonski discuss Curran's new book, Who's Black and Why? A Hidden Chapter from the 18th Century Invention of Race. Curran co-edited the book with Henry Louis Gates, Jr. This conversation originally took place May 4th, 2022, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
We're grateful to all of you watching today for supporting the past, present, and future of American writing. Tonight's program is offered in anticipation of the AWM's upcoming exhibit, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice, which uplifts the contribution of Black writers and looks at their influence on the periods between the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement, and the connection of those works to the writing and themes still present today. In 1739, Bordeaux's Royal Academy of Sciences announced a contest for the best essay on the sources of Blackness. 16 essays were written in French and Latin, were ultimately dispatched from all over Europe. The authors ranged from naturalists to physicians, theologians to amateur savants. Documented on each page are European ideas about who is Black and why. These never previously published documents survived the centuries tucked away in Bordeaux's municipal library. Translated into English and accompanied by a detailed introduction and headnotes written by Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Andrew Curran, each essay included in this volume lays bare the origins of anti-Black racism and colorism in the West. Andrew S. Curran is a leading specialist of the Enlightenment era and the author of The Anatomy of Blackness, and Diderot and the Art of Thinking Freely. He is the William Armstrong Professor of the Humanities at Wesleyan University. Andrew is here tonight with Nina G. Jablonski, Evan Pugh University Professor of Anthropology at the Pennsylvania State University. A biological anthropologist and paleontologist, she studies primate and human evolution and has specialized in the evolution of human skin and skin color. So please help me in welcoming Andrew Curran and Nina Jablonski. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carrie. This is a wonderful opportunity to discuss a remarkable book. Andrew, I'm sure you join me in saying we wish Skip were here, but we will hold the fort because this is a remarkable book that is worthy of lots of discussion. And I want to start out by asking you, you know, how did the collaboration with Skip Gates come about? Because this is a fascinating and readable book, but this is not the most sort of mainline kind of subject. It's an unexpected book. Let me just put it that way. So, so give me some of the backstory on how you guys got together and worked on this project.
Well, thanks. The funny part about this whole thing is we kind of both had the same idea separately. I had written about this for an earlier book, and I had everyone, I mean, occasionally in the scholarship, and you know this, Nina is an amazing scholar of the history of race, and I had heard references to this contest where they never gave a prize in 1741, and people kind of just dismissed the contest as not being terribly pertinent for the history of medicine or history of ideas. And I think that was a vestige of what historians call Whig history, because it didn't lead to something which is really easy to kind of plot in a line leading to a kind of progress and so on and so forth. But it was a really fascinating thing for me because it was this core sample, a vertical slice of history, what a whole bunch of different kinds of people were thinking about what we now call race in 1739. So I went and consulted the manuscripts in Bordeaux initially and wrote about them. And I wrote about five or six pages in a much larger kind of study. And in Cambridge at Harvard, about the same time, 10 or 12 years ago, Skip also had heard about this whole contest, a strange contest. And one of the people who works with him at the Hutchins Center was very keen on working on this as well. And for various reasons having to do with logistics at Harvard, there were some problems there with personnel, nothing bad, but just there's a kind of a health issue. And he said, you know what, Curran wrote about this. I'll get in touch with him. It's really funny because it was the day that my last book, the Diderot book, came out. He called me the exact same day. So it was this kind of crazy, crazy day. And he said, hey, you want to do a book together? And this is kind of the way he operates. He's just such an amazing impresario, super enthusiastic. And we had the most fruitful and wonderful collaboration, going back and forth, sometimes 10, 15 emails a day, writing together, thinking together. I went up to Cambridge a bunch of times and we thought through this whole question and how to kind of construct a book that had this contest, which was, as I said, this kind of vertical sample, vertical slice of what was going on right at the time when science was claiming the right to kind of create the thing we call race. And we also stumbled upon a second contest, which is in the book, a contest in 1772, which shows a very different, kind of an important shift in the way people are thinking about, again, what we're calling race, because the same Bordeaux Academy of Sciences at that point said they wanted to do a contest on how to improve the middle passage. This kind of terrifying idea. There was a call for papers primarily sent out to doctors to talk about how they could improve medical conditions on board the ships to improve, increase profits as well. So we talked about a lot of these things, how to kind of tell a story about these essays, and also how to tell a story about the history of race, which is something we really don't talk about it in the United States. We talk about the history of racism a lot and the history of slavery, but the history of race, where it came from, is really something we don't talk about. And that's what we're really thinking about in this book.
Yeah, Andrew, this is a fascinating unfolding, and I'm happy to hear about this wonderful serendipity with your one book finishing and the other book starting basically the same day. But for the benefit of our audience, what is so rich about this book is it has this wonderful introduction that you and Skip wrote, and then the 16 essays that were inaugurated in 1739 on the question of the origin of Blackness, and then a second shorter series of three essays from the 1741
No, the 1772, that's the second one,
1772 contest on preserving Negroes under slavery, as it was called. Yeah. And then lastly, there's a wonderful sort of glossary, a chronology on the representation of Africans and race. Now, as a scholar myself, this is a super resource. It is concentrated, it's well-written, it's beautifully understandable, and the essays are remarkably riveting. But for the benefit of people, most people who aren't looking at the minutiae here, why should they bother to read this? Why is this important for people to get their heads around?
Well, I'm going to answer this question. I'll get to the big part of your question, but I'm going to answer this question with an anecdote, I think, which is pretty, I think it helps us understand. This past fall, I taught a class called The Histories of Race at the Cheshire Penitentiary here in Connecticut, in the prison program we have here. And this was a class, and I don't call it the history of race because I find that there's lots of different kind of subplots in this whole thing. And I had 16 students, and 14 of them were of the incarcerated students were people of color. And they were drawn to this question, where does race come from? And even in this audience here, I could, ask I'm sure a very learned audience of American Writers Museum, probably most people don't really know where the idea of race came from or when, right? So, and it really is happening around 1741. So this is one of the things I wanted to explain to my students. And we work through, from the 17th century, some of the first people. We look at kind of classifiers, we look at travelogues, we look at legal documents, we look at history of science documents, doctors. We move all the way through to the real classifiers that you write about a lot, the classifiers, the German classifiers, the 1770s and 1780s, at which point race is really crystallizing. But, the idea of race doesn't really exist. I mean, the notion of race, the term race doesn't really exist. That's a zoological term that was used to be associated with kings and dogs It's a bloodline. It's a lineage. And the terms people use to refer to different ethnicities or different human groups were, there are a lot of different ones, you know, nation, genre in French, and variety as well. And variety is an interesting one often used by naturalists because it's a botanical metaphor. And that's very significant. A botanical metaphor implies hybridization, implies lots of different varieties. These are not trenchant kind of categories when you talk about a variety. It implies lots of different things. Whereas a race is a bloodline, a zoological kind of an animal type thing. And that's one of the things that's really going on here, this shift from these kind of botanical metaphors to kind of the zoological metaphors. And I think one of the things this book does, it really kind of shows how this crystallizes, particularly by looking at all these different people. So the book works both vertically and horizontally. Vertically in that it talks about the different kinds. I'm sure you'll ask us about this later on, the different kinds of essays submitted to the contest, naturalists and, you know, classifiers and so on and so forth. And at the same time, there's a horizontal history that allows the reader to understand where this idea comes from and when all of a sudden the word race is introduced and accepted as everybody. From my perspective, I'm writing a new book on this I'm calling The Race Makers, and it is a kind of a biography of race. And it shows how the racist functions kind of like a virus, I think. And we're always talking about viruses, but it really does. It's an idea that just kind of, you know, grows and metastasizes, and it just moves through and it shifts. It shifts over time. It shifts here in the United States, and the idea of race here is different from the way it is in West Africa. There's not one thing as race. It's this kind of huge construct. And going back and looking at this is really, really, really important. And to get back to my anecdote, one day a professor who was going to be teaching in the program, at this point we had gone online, he wanted to see how it would function online, teaching in a prison program in line, which you can't do by Zoom. You have to do it with Microsoft Teams because people can't have computers. So it's just one big screen. It's kind of off-putting. But the class was amazing. So he said, how's this class function? And I thought they would talk about, you know, the logistics of having a class online. And they all talked about what the class meant to them. And I was tearing up because a lot of them were saying, you know, they had never, I had no idea where it came from. And several of them said, you know, now I understand how my life was determined by these ideas, which were constructed in the 18th century. And this may seem as a burden to some of them, but there's one of the students said, you know, it's actually quite freeing. It's emancipatory to understand. And I quote him, he said, it's all bullshit. I can't believe it. So this is a huge realization for them. And I think people reading the book will get the same feeling, to understand that it is just something that's totally created. We always talk about race as a social construct, but we don't go back and kind of nail it down to see where it came from. And that's kind of what is happening in this book, I think. I hope you'll agree.
I agree, Andrew. I think this is immeasurably important because people are, we live in a highly racialized world, and yet we don't know how these races were first defined and why. Now, one of the things that has really riveted me over the years is just why blackness was such an issue. When I look at some of the writings of Portuguese explorers, one of the things that is fascinating is the shock that they experienced when they first explored the west coast of Africa. They express this incredible sort of a startle response over the appearance of the people. And the people, as far as we know, in West Africa also were startled by the appearance of the Europeans, but we don't have their records to refer to. But this whole idea that blackness is a shock, it's something that is almost beyond understanding. This seems to be behind the premise of the Bordeaux Academy's essay competition, is trying to understand why did this arise, and are the origins from some simple physical phenomena, or are they far more complex? And do they have to do with something in the moral fiber or the capacity for civilization or some other thing having to do with personality, character, and morality? I think this whole sort of the very idea of why Blackness is so different is an underpinning of this essay competition.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. Blackness has always been a quandary for people who don't have pigmented skin in that way. So from, and it doesn't start in the 18th century. It doesn't start in the 15th century, or it starts really, you know, who knows how long it you know, it's been going on. But certainly, you know, Hippocrates, you know, 4th century BC, is thinking about this. There's all sorts of explanations from antiquity that are circulating, most of them related to climate and Hippocrates. And then there's biblical kind of explanations and biblical exegesis, and various theologians are kind of adding on to that. So this has been something that's been a huge kind of question for a long time. And many of the explanations early on were somewhat pathological or ideological. They had to do with something going wrong, right? So, and that has been something that has always been part and parcel of kind of the idea of Blackness. I think if Skip were here, he'd say one of the things we do need to understand is that, you know, since, you know, one of the points of this book is that things are really shifting in the 17th and 18th century. Early on in the 15th century, absolutely, that same kind of feeling is still there. But there was also a lot of open-minded kind of exchanges. And in one of our recent conversations, Skip, he's got a fabulous encyclopedic mind for this, was talking about all the different kind of exchanges going on in the medieval era, and the fact that the Europeans were very, very interested in reaching out to the Prester John, the Black king in East Africa, kind of mythological king who would help them crush the Sarrazins and crush the Moors. And so it wasn't a racial kind of question, but there was a kind of geopolitical kind of relationship to the idea of Blackness at one point. And you see a lot of Black figures in medieval iconography, et cetera, who are not being portrayed in the way they're being portrayed in the 17th and 18th century. Now, really what happens in the 17th century, and this is one of the hugely important points, is that chattel slavery really comes online and as a European-wide phenomenon. And clearly the Portuguese and the Spaniards were the early adopters, particularly the Portuguese, and their relationship to Brazil, and certainly their colonization of Congo with a K. But once the Brits and the Dutch and the French and even the, you know, the Swedes, everyone's kind of getting involved, not really the Germans, people are getting involved with slavery on a much deeper level. And this actually increases the contact between Europeans and Africans to an astonishing extent. We think about Europeans going to Africa, but the contact was relatively limited because it was so dangerous, Africa being called the white person's grave. And there'd be, you know, small forts, you know, dozens of people, maybe 100 people in certain forts, but it's a really small contact, whereas you have tens of thousands of Europeans in contact with millions, ultimately millions of West Africans and people of West African descent, the colonies. And this is a laboratory for the creation of race. I think that's one of the very important points to make here tonight, is that this area produces a lot of new knowledge, knowledge that's related to the kind of creation of race. Bordeaux would not have created or, you know, proposed this contest had it not been for the fact that they also had a very deep relation to the Caribbean, which maybe we'll get to in a second. They could have done a contest on other ethnicities or races in 1740s. For example, the Laplanders, who were seen as far more inferior, quote unquote, than West Africans or people in sub-Saharan Africa. But they weren't interested in that. They were interested in Africans and Black skin, and Black skin being a symbol of slavery in a lot of ways. So these two things are synonymous. And again, you know, Bordeaux, it's important to think about Bordeaux and Bordeaux's relationship to the Caribbean. I talk too much now. You probably have a different question, but we can go back to Bordeaux in a second if you'd like.
Well, I think one of the fascinating aspects of this collection of essays is that they include all of these ideas about the shock of blackness and blackness as a disease or an indication of degeneracy or as a departure from normal. But then, as you point out, there is this sort of integration of what we would consider sort of a modern scientific approach and a willingness to sort of entertain people with black skin as being normal people who just look a little bit different. And so this is a fascinating sort of slurry of ancient, medieval, and proto-modern scientific ideas that are in some essays all sort of slurped together. And this is the sort of the fascinating contradictions. You can almost see in some of the individual essays that authors are wrestling with these primitive emotional ideas that they may have harbored, and then some of their own more scientific investigations. Before we go in specifically to slavery, which I do want to pursue with you, I want to ask you if you have any particular favorite essays that really sort of swallowed you up with their interest or bizarreness.
Yeah, so I actually have the book here, and I thought I'd run down the laundry list of some of the kind of the crazy things here. Yes. Here's the book, and very fast. And I'm actually going to channel Skip here because he's got his favorite one, and he thinks so funny. So some of these things had to do with the fact that some people were thinking through, they're much more concerned about biblical questions than they were actually about the source of blackness. They didn't care about the source of blackness, really. What they wanted to do is come up with an explanation that was perfectly compatible with the Bible and the idea that Noah's Ark lands in the Caucasus. That's where the expression Caucasian comes from later on. Noah's Ark lands in the Caucasus, and his three sons take off and are fruitful, and they multiply, and something happens as they move around the globe. And that's kind of the basic idea. And there's the myth of Ham we can come back to too, but that's the basic idea. And that's why the Bordeaux said, what is the degeneration of black hair and black skin? Because they didn't want to come up with an essay that implied that blacks were different, a different species, because that would be heretical. So this is a scientific contest that's constructed in a way that's completely compatible with the Bible. And I bring that up because in the explanations here, it's interesting. Some of these things are heretical, some of the explanations that come through. So one essay says that Adam and Eve were black, or Adam was half black. So that's an idea that there's like the first person is actually different. Clearly the Academy would not be interested in that. And then blackness is a mark of God's God denoting sinfulness. God made some people white, but some unknown exterior causes generated blackness. And then black skin is a God-given gift. And this is a kind of what historians call it kind of a teleological explanation, which is the idea that God did this on purpose. This is a providential thing. This is God's bounty, but God's goodness. So there's a reason for everything in the entire universe. And blackness is one of those things that it can be explained only through God's goodness. There's some typical kind of climate type things. And then, here's the one that Skip's favorite. And this is actually mine too. And it comes up a couple different places. And this is the theory of the maternal imagination, which is one of the funny things, which is we would think it's almost like mystical or magical, but it was seen as a real naturalistic, which to say not supernatural, it's a naturalistic phenomenon. The idea that a pregnant woman during the sex act or during gestation, depending on who's thinking about this, if she is thinking about certain images, those images can imprint on either the egg or the fetus. And so there is an explanation that a white woman is thinking about a black man during sex and has a black baby. This is Skip's favorite, by far. He thought this was just a hilarious, and he always brings it up. There's some really strange ones too. People are kind of taking ideas from outside of what we would kind of think of as the kind of birth of race. Somebody's looking at Newtonian optics and applying the idea of light fragmentation on black skin. All sorts of weird stuff. Blackness arises from vapors from the skin. Africans have black semen. There's all sorts of kind of physiological things here too. And I think the anatomical explanations are incredibly important, because what's going on when people start supplying real anatomical explanations? I mean, these things have been floating around as well for a long, long time, but in the 18th century, they are being accepted by scientific academies. And what's really critical to think about here is that the idea, if we think of race as being kind of about skin, but it's way more than that. It's something that's on the inside. And when race starts kind of going to the inside, then it's able to be associated with physiological things, cognitive abilities, all sorts of different aspects of the body. It really kind of creates a separate category. If a skin is just an accident, then there's really no kind of functional difference. And for a long time, you know, the reason that race doesn't really exist, I mean, prejudice, xenophobia, genocide, all these things have been floating around forever. But race, the idea that different categories are kind of biological entities that you can measure and you can kind of predict how people will be based on who they are, you know, thinking about kind of biological criteria, that is race, heredity, destiny, and kind of physiological, anatomical kind of things. So that's, I think, really important to keep in mind. So I didn't really answer your question, except we'd love the maternal imagination. Skip and I were always joking about that one, but there's a laundry list of things. And I think the most serious ones here have to do with anatomy.
Yeah. And this really leads to the question of, you know, how, as these races were being framed and thought of, people were clearly associating the color with other qualities, inner qualities of people. And these in turn had to do with one's or people's suitability for slavery and enslavement. Could you comment on this? Because clearly one of the underlying themes of these essays is how the physical, physiological, and emotional traits of people with black skin somehow make them more suitable for slavery. And this works at the same time with some of the theological or pseudo-theological explanations or justifications for slavery. Could you elaborate on some of these things? Because I think this is really important for people to understand that there was a real connect the dots trajectory here toward the creation of an inferior type of person or being that was worthy of enslavement, and that this was sort of determined by anatomy as well as theological destiny?
Wow, that's a fabulous question, such a deep question. You know, normally, I don't kind of go in for kind of real periodization, because I always find there's exceptions. By periodization, I'm talking about things happen like this in, you know, 1940, 1950, 1960, and same thing in 1740, 1750, 1760, but I'm going to do it anyway. So for a long time, slavery really did not need to be justified, or in fact, it justified itself based on these theological kind of questions. So there's always kind of the proto-racism floating around there, but the real kind of justification was that you give up your body, but you gain eternal salvation. And here we have to kind of think a little bit about comparative slavery, because what happens in the, you know, Catholic countries who are enslaving is entirely different from what happens with England, for example. England said you don't enslave Christians. Now, this kind of breaks down, of course, but you don't enslave Christians, so these are, you know, they're essentially subhumans. So from the very beginning in the kind of English sphere, you wouldn't want to baptize people. It's a kind of a more brutal kind of ideology, as even if the kind of what happens on the ground is very similar, the idea of the kind of conceptual idea of Africans in the English context here in the States too is much more brutal. In the Spanish and French context, the Spaniards, Portuguese, I believe both would baptize before people would go do the middle passage. And the French, according to the Code Noir, would be baptized once they got to the island. So the idea is you're gaining eternal salvation. And so that was the thing that really justified slavery for a long, long time. Now, one of the things that's happening at the same time that these academies are getting interested in the question of kind of physiology and race is that overall, there's a progressive desacralization of just general thought. So as people start moving beyond some of the kind of traditional dogma, the idea that the earth is 5,841 years old or something like that, at when the contest is being held, 741 years old. The idea that, you know, Noah's Ark lands and Noah has three kids, people are starting to kind of not buy that anymore by the 1740s. And at that point, these people are much more open to these scientific explanations. What happens? The justification of slavery is no longer working. It's not a coincidence that in the 1750s, people are starting to criticize slavery from a philosophical point of view. And it's not a coincidence either at that point that some of the kind of racist or proto-raciology that's floating around is going to be harnessed by the pro-slavery people who are defending themselves. The contest in 1741 is kind of right at the cusp, because no one's really kind of worried about justifying slavery, particularly in Bordeaux. But at the same time, they that's reflected by the fact that the contest is constructed entirely apolitically. There's no mention of enslaved Africans at all. It's skin and hair, and that's it. So there's these snippets of Africans. But of course, it's very much linked to the expansion of the slave trade that's taking place in Bordeaux at the time. Bordeaux was not very involved in the slave trade early on. By the 1740s, it's getting pretty involved. And by 1789-90, it becomes the first port. And Bordeaux deports 150,000 Africans during the time that they're involved with slavery. And if you remember that demographics are very, very different, the entire population of Bordeaux, in 1770 was probably 90,000. So it's deporting way more than your own population over a certain number of years. So the numbers are pretty staggering here too. So, yeah, I think that, if we go from decade to decade, you can kind of see that shift from kind of religious justifications to scientific justifications and increased interest in looking at African bodies in a way that it's much more clinical and then much more political. And the African body becomes a place where not only are people deriving scientific information, anatomical information, the study of Black anatomy becomes part and parcel of the pro-slavery lobby.
Yeah, and this body of information, these diverse scientific and philosophical ideas, they don't just exist among philosophers and naturalists or a few politicians. These become gradually more widely broadcast. And what is fascinating and really important for human history here is how these early scientific, philosophical, and pseudo-theological ideas about Blackness and suitability for slavery are sort of mobilized, motorized, embellished, and used as energy for the slave trade. Just when that resistance to the slave trade, as you describe, is beginning to be felt in the mid-1700s, this is when the rhetoric on the part of sort of everybody else, the choruses of society, including politicians, mercantilists, really begin to sort of chime in and say, hey, look at all this evidence pointing in this direction. Mm. I find that, it's deeply disturbing, but this is really sort of an early propagation of social, not social media, but it's propagandizing and distorting this information for particular mercantile and political ends.
Yeah, again, a great point. I think that one of the things we should emphasize at this point is that during this era of desacralization, as I'm calling it, an increased secular perspective on all sorts of different topics. At the time, there's this new anthropocentrism as well. You know, the whole idea that Pope says the proper study of mankind is man. There's this anthropocentric and anthropological thing that's kind of coming online during the 18th century. And that dovetails with increased literacy too. Yeah. So looking back, you know, in 1720s, you know, not that many people are reading. And the only books, I mean, the books that most people are reading are going to be religious books. And by the 1740s and 50s, travel literature starts displacing religious texts as the most important and popular things. And then more and more people are able to read. One of the things I wrote about in the Anatomy of Blackness book, where I did a huge kind of study of a lot of these things, was that, and this is the thing that's, I think, stunned me more than anything else, is that I was looking at everything. And I looked at children's geography books and books and journals written for women, because women all of a sudden are just, the literacy rate of women just takes off in the 1770s. And you can't find a better school for racism in these two things. It's almost a catechism of racism in both instances, where a kind of a male professor would be reading questions like, Nina, do you know about what happens in South Africa? And then the responses that you would read and you would memorize were just a series of horrific racial things, you know? So it's fascinating to see that these things are all kind of linked up. And your point about, you know, physiology, justification of slavery brings me to Montesquieu, who is actually a member of the Bordeaux Academy of Sciences, right? The Bordeaux Academy of Sciences is different from a university. Universities are designed to replicate knowledge in the 18th century. They're almost vocational schools in some way. Theologians, priests, doctors, lawyers, and they're not interested in kind of research. The 19th century research universities are the next century. See, the academies are kind of popped up in kind of in reaction to these rear guard universities. They're interested in kind of humanistic pursuits and enlightened ideas. And Montesquieu is a member of that. Montesquieu, the great fascinating relativist, the author of the Persian Letters, and also the author of, which is more important for us, The Spirit of the Laws, which, among other things, puts forward a theory of separation of state, which becomes incredibly important for both England and the what will become the United States. I bring him up because he's a fascinating instance of how these two kind of sides of Enlightenment thought are in conflict. He was very interested in environmental kind of theories of humans. He was also very interested in Africans. Mm-hmm. And he thought that he was, as a philosopher, he rejected Aristotle's idea of natural slaves, but at the same time, he said, you know, in certain climates, things happen to bodies and they don't have the same kind of cognitive potential. And if I had to admit this, a certain place where slavery or slaves would really come from, it would be in these kind of tropical zones. He was careful not to kind of talk about Africans there, but in his other writing, talking about Saint-Domingue, what we know as Haiti now, he was saying that Africans were very, very lazy. So he was really talking about them. He could kind of say there's this little space, kind of an ethnographic or ethnological space, where maybe slavery makes sense. At the same time, he's the father of anti-slavery thinking. In the same book, the Spirit of the Laws is a big mess in a lot of ways. There's a lot of contradictory ideas, and he's the person who actually refutes the justification of slavery, taking all the different explanations and kind of making fun of them in a very ironic, sarcastic, satirical kind of 18th century voice. So here we have someone, member of the Bordeaux Academy, fascinated with both Enlightenment ideas, fascinated with environmental kind of theory, and also as a political philosopher, knowing that slavery is really wrong. And yet he is weighed down by these explanations. And there's many, many different examples of people like that who are looking at these physiological kind of components. And he was kind of a goodish type person in a lot of ways. He was not remembered for his kind of proto-raciology. He's really remembered for his anti-slavery ideas. But there are a lot of people who are going to make use of some of the ideas that are floating around the Bordeaux Academy and will really weaponize those things in the 1750s and 1760s, for sure.
Yeah. I want to know, we know that Montesquieu was read by many or several New World politicians, our future so-called founding fathers among them. Did any of the framers of the American Constitution, any slaveholders in the proto-US, had they read the Bordeaux essays, and did they have any influence on their thinking?
There's only one essay that was published during the 18th century, so that's why this is this interesting kind of gold mine, and it's the essay number 16 in the book by a guy by the name of Barrère, which is Barrere, mm-hmm. And he was an anatomist, and unlike anyone else, he actually had a lot of contact with Africans. Unfortunately, he had that contact in Guyana, where he was a surgeon on a plantation. So when Africans died, he dissected them, and he came up with this insane idea, as many of the anatomists did at that time, that Africans had black bile and black blood. And this idea had been floating around for a long time, but this became something very, very kind of real. And everyone thought everyone accepted this as fact, in the same way we've accepted the reality of gravity for a long time. And you can kind of trace the importance of this because people are citing Barrère, who was incited to do this by the Bordeaux Academy, throughout the decades. And it shows up in Thomas Jefferson's notes on State of Virginia, and where he is not exactly sure where race comes from, but he sure as hell cites all these different things. And among them, he doesn't use Barrère's name, but he cites Barrère's discovery. It certainly came from him. And we can kind of, one of the things I'm thinking about right now is tracing the link between French science and Thomas Jefferson, because there's a huge untold story, I think, there, which involves, it's a kind of a archive sniffing that goes from Barrère all the way through. It's really, really interesting because some of the worst ideas that Jefferson had, and there are many of them, come from his experience in France. I mean, he's hanging out with Louis XVI, having dinner with Louis XVI every Tuesday night. And at the same time, he's doing research and hanging out with various people in Paris, a lot of them like-minded, gentlemen naturalists. So yes, the Bordeaux Academy of Science contest, although it was declared a failure, has a pretty long legacy, and you can just trace it all the way through to even the before the United States. Yeah.
And lastly, and I won't make this into a question so much as a short comment. What resides in my mind is the fact that these ideas about race have been very sticky in history and in the public consciousness for decades, for centuries. These have not gone away. And there are still lots of ideas, as you alluded to at the beginning, when you were talking to your class and your classmates and students were sharing with you that they had never heard about this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so they had heard a lot of hearsay about how race was invented, but they didn't know where a lot of this information had come from. I think to establish the historical sequence of narrative that created these races as they've unfolded in different places at different times is so very important. We talking about it as a social construct is just waffle, and it's not good enough, because we can see this as historically and culturally defined as known events. It's not some kind of amorphous thing. So I've just enjoyed terrifically this conversation, Andrew, and I think this book is worth reading by virtually every adult American to understand what predicament or how we got into the predicament of race that we are in.
Just one quick comment. I want to thank everyone here so much. Nina, you're a fabulous person to chat with. We could do this for hours. It's so great. And I would also want to thank the American Writers Museum for inviting us here tonight. It's been really wonderful.
And I just wanted to say thank you, both of you, Andrew, Nina. This was an absolutely stellar and fascinating discussion. We're thrilled to have had a chance to talk about this book. Thank you to everyone for joining us tonight for this wonderful program, and have a great night.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, Doug Conant discusses his book, The Blueprint, 6 Practical Steps to Lift Your Leadership to New Heights. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.